Welcome to the Canadian Real Estate Investor, where hosts Daniel Foch and Nick Hill navigate the market and provide the tools and insights to build your real estate portfolio.
Welcome back to another episode of the Canadian Real Estate Investor Podcast. My name is Nick Hill. I am a real estate investor, a mortgage broker, and just a guy that loves real estate and loves working with other people that are trying to do real estate transactions across the country. So if you're interested, reach out to my co-host or myself. And I'm joined today and every Tuesday by none other than Mr. Daniel Foch. Dan, how you doing today?
I'm good. It's weather looks like it's supposed to be nice here in the GTA. So, I mean, what other things would I possibly have to complain about since winter started when spring officially started here in the GTA? Yeah, I mean, and I'm excited. We got a good episode here today. So today we're going to be talking about a bunch of different news that we feel you need to know as a real estate investor. So what are we going to be looking at today, Nick?
Yeah, today we're going to start off by looking at Ontario's budget and the battle to balance it.
I thought budgets balance themselves in this country.
You know what? I think a few people did. And I really wish, I mean, my personal budget, I really wish that balanced itself. But apparently, they do not.
Yeah, so we're going to be looking at Ontario's budget and what it says about housing. We're also going to be looking at population projections and how much drop-off we could potentially see in international students with the new imposed caps.
Yeah, major drop-offs in population seemingly around the corner. I'm sure we all remember hitting that 40 million mark in June of 2023. Less than a year later, we are officially at 41 million. So rapid growth, but that rapid growth, that rapid rate of growth seems to be changing. And then finally, we're going to look at the federal government promising a renter's bill of rights in its upcoming budget and what that means and some highlights from that proposed bill.
Yeah, so let's just dive right into it. The first topic that we're covering today is a headline that says Ontario's deficit will triple as the economy weakens. 2024 budget shows the province pushes back balanced budget date to 2026. This comes from the CBC.
Yeah, thanks, Dan. Now, before we get into this, it's important to remember how big Ontario is. There's just shy of 16 million people in the province. The province is home to Canada's largest city, Toronto, its capital, Ottawa, and it's generally used as a leading indicator for a number of reasons. One, the size, but also just the fact that there's more data available here than anywhere else because things are tracked more heavily here. So that's why this first piece is covering Ontario's budget. We want to see what Ontario is doing, the challenges that Ontario is facing, so that we can maybe look at those and apply them to the rest of Canada. Now, we do have an episode coming out that is on all different levels of government across the country and what they plan to do to achieve housing and economic goals. But this one is just about Ontario. And that is my disclaimer as to why we've decided to focus on Ontario, not to leave any other province out.
Yeah, I think it's also interesting and worth observing Ontario simply because I think when policy can take place in a province that is as difficult of a political environment as Ontario, it kind of paves the way for what you're seeing elsewhere in the province. I mean, we saw this with Bill 23 happening in Ontario, where they upzoned to, or like hypothetically upzoned to, three units on a residential lot in the province. And now there's kind of this political battle forming between Doug Ford and Bonnie Crombie. Bonnie Crombie saying we should go fourplex across the board as of right in Ontario, and Doug Ford kind of shouting back against that. And I think it's worth observing, also being the larger portion of the Canadian population. I guess it's just that gravitational pull of the center of the universe or whatever it is in Toronto, right?
that tractor beam of hey, come check this out. And then a lot of people come here, realize that it's pretty damn expensive to live here, and they migrate interprovincially elsewhere, as we've done many episodes on. But you're totally right, Dan. It you know, Ontario comes up a lot because one, Dan and I both live here. Most of our listeners are here, even though we have amazing listeners across the country. But again, Ontario just seems to be either the leading or the lagging indicator when it comes to everything. So really great data points. With all that being said, Dan, start walking me through what some of the budget highlights we have here are.
Yeah. So one of the things I think a lot of people dismiss in when thinking about interest rates is that governments also pay interest. And so high interest rates are taking a toll on most budgets right now, with I think the government of Canada just hitting the highest interest expense they've ever paid and the highest percentage of their total budget in interest that they've ever paid. And, you know, if you know much about politics and sovereign debt in Canada, we are one of the most indebted governments in the world, with Ontario having the largest, I think one of the largest or like top 10 largest debt for an individual state, like not a country. And so high interest rates obviously are going to take a toll on Ontario's economy this year, is what the CBC article says. And they mentioned this in their 2024 budget, which included projections of weak economic growth and a ballooning deficit as a result of spending more and more money on interest. Usually, you'll hear like this concept of austerity, which eventually needs to take place to start getting these budgets moving in the right direction, which, you know, is a reduction in government spending and social programs as a corrective measure to try and protect against future financial crises, big debt crises from a government level. We haven't seen anything like that come up yet, but it would be worth paying attention to see if we start hearing about, because that's like when you really get to like the depressive part of a recession, this is how all of these things, interest rates climbing, household debt being high, but government debt being high, that's where you really start to feel the impact of how bad a recession can be when the government is in a state of financial crisis and they have to start peeling back social services. Just yesterday, there was an article that came out in Bloomberg about how Canada's social safety net is eroding, which was an amazing article. I actually think we should probably cover it, but they cover decades and decades of policy and how it's all compounded. It's hospital wait times and housing and
yeah,
all that.
Yeah, I was going to say, even just that chart you posted this morning, I know, you know, we're getting quite off topic talking about hospital wait times. This is a real estate show, but hey, that all goes to show the inner workings of the economic machine that we've built here, right? And if something as simple but as absolutely crucial as a hospital wait time has, like, what was that, like tripled or quadrupled or something like that over the last few decades? I mean, you know, I don't know. Like that's not good.
Yeah, I think a lot of this is like, because our birth rate is so low, in order to sustain demand for real estate, we're like exporting the importing of people, right? So we're exporting housing. You can't export housing. You can't ship houses to another country. So you export like the living in Canada. And if the reasons that people want to live here start to erode, then it's plausible to believe that it could become less compelling for someone to want to live in Canada. Anyway, I definitely went off track there. So let's get back on track and talk about this article. So the financing minister tabled the government's $214 billion budget at Queen's Park, saying it is investing in housing, roads, and public services during a time of uncertainty without raising taxes. So again, no more revenue coming in, but they're going to spend a bunch more money. The 200-page document forecasts Ontario's deficit will be more than triple from $3 billion last year to $9.8 billion in 2024-2025.
Wow.
It is funny, right? Because we have like this left and right kind of political debate, but like conservatives aren't even really like fiscally conservative anymore, right? Like they definitely like to spend money just as much as everyone else.
Who doesn't, buddy? We're Canadian at this point. That's what we do best, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the same thing happened in the States too, right? Like, you know, you had the last election or before where it was run that, oh, we're going to, you know, cut government spending and waste and whatever. And it was at, I think, and the pandemic, you can't discount, obviously, the pandemic was a pretty expensive endeavor, but it wasn't any different than a government of the alternative side of the political spectrum. So anyway, the province doesn't expect to return to balance until 2026, 2027, which is, I think, probably pretty optimistic. then that's the year of the next election when a $500 million surplus is projected. But I think that would only take place after the election. You have to elect them if you want the surplus.
Of course. Of course. Have you ever even heard of politics before? Come on.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, I'm no mathematician here, Dan. You know, out of the two of us, you would be more the mathematician. You might not be a mathematician here either. But to go from $3 billion to $9.8 billion to then suddenly a $500 million surplus, I just don't see how that works out. Anyways, the increase to the deficit, again, from going to $3 billion to almost $10 billion, was largely caused by slowing economic growth, projections leading to lower tax revenues, and but also due to an expected drop in revenue caused by none other than the federal cap on international study permits. So international students is another way of saying that. And we'll get to that because I know that's come up a lot on the show from several different perspectives, right? Canada's growth, kind of how screwed over some of these poor international students have been as they've come here and attended strip mall colleges and have kind of been left wanting. And then, of course, from a real estate perspective, what that is going to do to the housing market and specifically certain asset classes, student rentals and other student accommodations in college or university town. So the outlook for economic growth has deteriorated significantly over the last year, the government says, with gross domestic product, that's GDP, expected to slow to 0.3% in 2024, down from the estimate of 1.2%. So that is brutal. 1.2 down to 0.3. And now while GDP is expected to recover in guess what year? Election year, potentially, to 1.9 and 2.2 over the next 2 years, those numbers are still below previous forecasts. And Dan, this GDP and GDP per capita has come up a lot recently. As we said, we've posted some pretty good charts on social media about it. And, you know, again, numbers don't lie. This stuff is getting pretty bad.
Yeah. So, It's interesting from my perspective, like when you look at GDP and inflation. So the article goes on to talk about inflation, and I'll read this, and then I'm gonna provide a little bit of an opinion here. So inflation is expected to slow from 3.8% in 2023 to 2.6% in 2024. We're already almost there. We're at 2.8%, I think, before returning to the target rate of 2% in 2025, according to projections from the finance ministry. So one of the interesting parts here is that all of these projected growths in GDP are currently below the rate of inflation of, you know, we're in the mid twos. And in 2025, they're saying 2.2% GDP growth, which would be just above inflation. So all of the...
If we get to that 2%.
Yeah, if we get to 2%, then so basically your economy is actually experiencing no real growth, right? Real meaning adjusted for inflation. Now, also adjust this for population growth, and the story gets even more grim. So
no, please don't do that.
So if your GDP is growing at 2% nominally and your inflation is at 2%, so your inflation is growing at 0% in real terms, adjusted for inflation, and your population is growing at even 1%, then your GDP per capita is outgrowing your real GDP. And so your real GDP per capita is falling. And we've seen it falling for 6 quarters now. Nick and I posted a chart that seems to have gotten a little bit of attention on Instagram, which it just came from NBF, National Bank Finance. Their economic department is on fire right now, not going to lie.
Yeah.
We should have them on the show sometime. They're just, well, all the economists are just beating up Canada right now. Like, they're just absolutely... Well,
They're probably looking at the numbers and being like, this would look really good on a chart.
Well, even the Bank of Canada themselves, actually, if we're doing the news episode, the Bank of Canada themselves, Carolyn Rogers, the deputy governor, who is incredibly good at pressers, actually, she came out and said that we're in an economic emergency right now. Our productivity growth is an economic emergency, which is...
Yeah, I mean, you never want to hear the word emergency from a government, especially when it comes to economics. That, I mean, that's a pretty bold statement, right? That's a pretty eye-catching statement.
For sure. Yeah. So anyway, let's get back to the article if you want to just read a little bit more about the budget here.
Yeah, for sure. So it goes on to say the budget outlines a whole number of things that the government wishes to accomplish, but this is a real estate show. So we are going to chat about the real estate specific things, which are the new funds for housing, that portion of the budget. So to support the province of Ontario's housing plans, the government is investing more than $1.8 billion in two different funds that will help municipalities build housing enabling infrastructure. So that includes things like roads and bridges, wastewater, stormwater, drinking water, all the infrastructure we need to support the things. You can't just go put a house on a piece of land. The house needs what's called servicing and the infrastructure around that. So that is what some of that budget is going to be used for. The province will also allow all single and upper tier municipalities to impose a tax on vacant homes. Now, we did a whole episode on the underused tax for vacant homes, and this has come up quite a bit. Now, currently only Toronto, Ottawa, and Hamilton have that authority to tax vacant homes. So a new policy framework would encourage municipalities to set a higher rate for foreign owned vacant homes. Now, that might move the needle a little bit, but that is not really a solution. And again, we'll see how much of all of this just turns out to be talk versus action.
You know, the part that I find interesting, and you were just at the Ontario Home Builders Association event where I was on a panel there, is this idea that like that we have just such a disjointed tax structure. So let's just like back up here, because we just mentioned it on another episode about talking about development charges. But it says to support the province of Ontario's housing plan, the government is going to invest in funds that will help municipalities build infrastructure, roads, bridges, and drinking water, wastewater, etc. Weren't we being told, or aren't we being told by municipalities, that development charges exist because growth pays for growth, and you as a developer are paying for them, you're paying into a fund for all of those things? So now we have the federal government giving money to municipal governments for all of this infrastructure. We have the municipal governments charging developers on an individualized basis for all of this infrastructure. And now the provincial government is saying that they're also going to throw money at the problem. And yet development charges are coming from developers' pockets, which ultimately ends up getting capitalized into the new cost structure of a brand new house. We have three people throwing money at the development of infrastructure for new housing, yet buyers are still expected to pay a fee for the infrastructure for new housing. And we're wondering why we can't create affordable housing here. So anyway, it goes on to say that they've proposed some sort of solution, which is that municipalities will be allowed to lower their property taxes on new purpose-built rental housing to encourage more construction of those units. So let's just actually really unpack that. Like, what would taxes be as a percentage of your total expenses, right? So when you look at, this is a Canadian Real Estate Investor podcast, so let's actually talk about this. You get your income, you deduct your taxes, maintenance, and insurance, right? So taxes are going to be, I mean, if you're you know, a six unit building, but I think it, as soon as you go commercial, like over four, the taxes go up like way more on a per suite basis. But we'll use that because of MLI Select program. Taxes by comparison to like maintenance or insurance or interest rates are pretty nominal, right? It's not a huge line item. Like, I can't see a small reduction in tax rates really making a deal a pencil.
That's not going to be the thing that makes deals that weren't working pencil out if taxes get lowered by a few points.
Maybe if it's like a 50% reduction in taxes on purpose-built rental, like, sure.
Yeah.
Or, you know, like that would move the needle enough to push a, you know, a 1.18 debt service coverage ratio to a 1.2 debt service coverage ratio. And now all of a sudden the deal pencils. But to me, and this is what I mentioned at the Ontario Home Builders Association panel, and by the way, we're going to have a bunch of people, members and people from the Home Builders Associations on the show over time, because we really like that group of people. But what I had mentioned at this event was, why are we not discussing development charges? So to go back to that tax structure, the federal government has removed GST on purpose-built rentals now. The provincial government has now removed GST on purpose-built rentals in the province of Ontario. Why isn't everybody looking at the municipalities and saying, hey, we did our part, where's yours, right? Because we know that development, or that taxes and charges are 31% of the cost structure of housing. So anyway, before I get too crazy on tax policy and trying to publicly bully municipalities into making it cheaper to build purpose-built housing. But it, like, the reality is, these, it's not that developers don't want to build housing. It's that they can't, because it, the numbers just
they don't want to build it at a loss, because that's not good business.
And it's not even like you're, yeah, and it's not even like you're saying, like, when it comes full circle, it's the government who's also preventing them. Like, who's underwriting these deals? Who's the one saying, oh, this deal doesn't pencil? CMHC, right? CMHC says, we're not going to insure this loan because it doesn't meet our debt service coverage requirement, or the construction cost is too expensive because of your development charges. Okay, well, so now all of a sudden, if it comes full circle, it ends up being like that Spider-Man meme with everybody pointing at, you know, the other part of the government. So anyway, there were 89,000 housing starts in Ontario in 2023, with 87,000 projected for 2024, 92,000 for 2025, 94,000 for 2026. All are well below the pace of at least 150,000 per year needed to achieve the province's goal.
Yeah, and that province's goal is to build 1.5 million new homes by 2031. So, you know, we're at minimum 50,000 to 60,000 homes less per year to hit that goal. So compound that, and, you know, we're hundreds of thousands of homes short by 2031. Now, earlier when we were discussing the Ontario budget, I don't want to say disaster, but the Ontario budget, we mentioned the increase in the deficit. Remember, that went from 3 to almost 10 billion, was caused by slowing economic growth projections leading to lower tax revenues, but also one of the major things was an expected drop in revenue caused by the federal cap on international study permits.
So we obviously have spoken at length about population growth, international students, the strip mall college, you know, there's a lot of fraud going on, student rentals, and overall what this inflow of students has done to the economy and the housing market.
Yeah, so here is a quick refresher. Now, we've done full episodes on this, but this does pertain to exactly what we're talking about here. So you guys can't see this because you are listening, but Dan and I are looking at this chart that we've looked at. It's actually more of an Excel spreadsheet, like, really, but it's basically each college, their growth from 2014 to 2015, their growth from 2021 to 2022, the change represented as a percentage and the growth represented as a percentage. There's about 20 or so schools on here. The average growth percentage is over 240%, with some of the outliers hitting 1,500, 1,700, 4,600%, 3,990%. So just exorbitant amounts of growth in some of these colleges that literally flung open their doors and started dishing out, like Oprah style, you get a student visa, you get a student visa, and just started to accept international students like it was nobody's business. So seeing a cap in this Ontario, because most of these are in Ontario, a lot of these colleges are in Ontario, seeing a cap put on this is going to definitely have an effect. And Dan, you're gonna walk me through some of the significant changes to international students that the Canadian government announced.
Yeah, so a couple of key points on it. So the number of study permits will be capped for 2 years, with a limit of about 36,000 set for 2024, representing a 35% reduction from 2023 levels. Different quotas will be set.
Sorry, Dan, that's 360,000, not 36,000.
Oh, my bad. It's too early for me to be reading numbers. 360,000. Yeah, 36,000 would be catastrophic.
Yeah, that's like one school basically right there.
Yeah. So there will be different quotas for different provinces. So it'll end up being kind of shifted around with the objective of balancing things and balancing the impact on infrastructure, with Ontario facing a reduction of 50% or more. So this is going to be a huge, like, this will be a noticeable impact in Ontario. Just like, to be fair, just like the impact of the growth was noticeable in Ontario, and I think probably noticeable in a lot of places, but the reduction will also be noticeable from my perspective. New enrollments in the public-private partnership college programs, which is basically like where a lot of that fraud was taking place, a lot of these strip mall groups existed, will no longer be eligible for the postgraduate work permit. So basically, there was a post-graduation work permit where you could finish a program, you would get a work permit, and a lot of colleges were exploiting this, or a lot of institutions were popping up to exploit this, realizing that what the international students wanted wasn't actually an education. It was the work permit. Like, they want to come and work and contribute to the Canadian economy and get jobs. So that was a big reduction. Spouses and common law partners of new international students will no longer be able to or be eligible for open work permits except for graduate, master's or doctorates, and professional degree granting programs. So these changes, obviously coupled with earlier policies and the reinstatement of a 20-hour per week work limit and the elimination of that postgraduate work permit extensions, will definitely have a significant impact on how this whole thing interacts with, especially, I would say, rental demand in Canada.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, and again, just to reiterate, Ontario facing a 50% or more reduction. So just like, you know, since we've started this show, Dan, the numbers that we've said, like, most of these numbers aren't normal, right? Something goes up 50, 100, 3, 4, 5, 600% in the thousands of percent. There's likely something wrong there. That is a red flag to me. Just like if there's a reduction of 50%, that is also a red flag, mm-hmm. and that needs to be taken into account. So just like we saw, like, crazy changes on the way up, we are going to see crazy changes on the way down. Now, I'm just going to give a quick shout out here. Go follow Exelon, X-E-L-A-N on Twitter. Actual friend of the show, Alex. He put together this great thread. Also has a killer.
On the note of you saying earlier that I was not a mathematician, Alex actually is a mathematician. He's actually a math magician. And he has a paid Substack. I think he has it paywalled now. Like, he does some free articles and some paid ones. But like, one of the few researchers that I would gladly support. I remember like a couple years ago, he launched, I think he paid one, and I was like done immediately. Like, it was just like a shut up and take my money kind of thing. Like, and so he creates amazing value. I would highly recommend checking out his research. He actually supports me on the Rare Report as well.
Yeah. Yeah. You work with him on the Rare Report that we usually cover here. As you said, killer newsletter, puts together a bunch of like what I would consider somewhat proprietary stuff, where he'll take data similar to us and put it into charts. Anyways, he has the annual population growth in Canada on his X, formerly known as Twitter feed, dropping from about 1.2 million that we experienced this year down to about 240,000 for the years between 2025 and 2027. He's got this, this great chart here that goes back to 1992 all the way to 2026 that shows kind of population kind of steadily around the 400,000 mark from 1992 to about 2014. From 2016 to 2020-ish, we see it jump just above 400 and then skyrocket up to the right at 1 million in 2023 or 2022-ish, 2023, 1 million, 1.2 million. And then it drops substantially after that. Dan, anything I'm missing? You are the chart master here.
Yeah, the only thing that I would say that is worth looking at on this chart is how in the next 3 years, so 2025, 6, and 7, you actually see, so there's two bars on this, your immigration, so that's people who are getting permanent residency, and then there's non-permanent residence. So immigration is blue, non-permanent residence is green. And you notice that the green bars are below zero in the next 3 years. So they're actually anticipating a net outflow of non-permanent residence. So the idea is that non-permanent residence will actually be reduced from 6.2% to 5% of the total population. So I'm going to explain, I'm just going to read his assumptions from the actual article where Alex explains this. So between July 1st, so it says here the assumptions used here between July 1st, 2023 to 2024, net NPR growth is assumed at 700,000. Immigration levels for 2024 to 2026 remain unchanged. Natural population increase and other components will remain around the same levels seen in recent years. So those are the assumptions that he used.
Yeah, and he goes on to say, why was my initial estimate significantly lower? Well, for simplicity, I calculated using a 40 million population. Well, it's close to 41 million now. And actually, correction, Alex, it just hit 41 million, I believe, yesterday or the day before, which was even faster than most people expected because they were predicting sometime in early mid-April. This is Thursday, March 28th that we are recording this. So it happened sooner than everyone expected. I used a 6.2% share of non-permanent residents from the announcement. However, by July of 2024, it should be closer to 7%. So now it represents a larger decline. So from 7% down to 5%. And he goes in to say that the outflow of NPR is expected regardless. So he's uncertain about the potential impact of it, even if it were to be implemented and all to go as planned here. So a few key takeaways I want to discuss here with you, Dan, before we move on to the final part here, which is the Renter's Bill of Rights. So stay tuned for that. But quick little discussion here on what this outflow and this cap and stuff is going to do to the housing market. What does it mean for investors? And specifically, what does it mean for certain asset classes like student rentals? Because just in our, not our last episode, but a few episodes ago, we covered that Royal LePage report where it really broke down who invests in what and what and at what age and all that kind of good stuff. And one of the key factors that stood out to me there was it seems like a ton of Canadian investors own investment properties that are likely student residence or student rental housing, or at least in a student or like in like a college or a university town. So when we see a massive cap on this stuff, what do you think is going to happen to that specific part of the housing market?
Yeah, I mean, my perspective is like this is really a big threat to those markets. We saw basically, since COVID and interest rates went to zero and housing demand went crazy, prices went so high. And the only way you could really cash flow a property at those purchase prices was through student rental. And then, and actually, we just covered this in the Royal LePage report, right? One in four investors want to buy real estate. 50% of them are thinking about being close to a school. So 50% are already thinking about being student rental investors. But one of the challenges here is, so you think about all of those houses that were purchased in 2020, 2021 that were too expensive and wouldn't have cash flowed to long-term rentals. So a lot of them were making into student rental pools, or a lot of investors were going that route to be able to cash flow. And then prices came down, but rates went up. And so now if you're buying at current rates, you still need to maximize your cash flow, and still the way to do it. Even a lot of the people that we have in our course want to get into student rental investing. And we just say, okay, well, make sure that you're aware of this table that we mentioned, that Nick read some of the percentages off of in this episode earlier. The reality is those markets are highly at risk for a bit of a correction. It doesn't mean they're not going to be investable in the fullness of time, but in the short term, there will be some turbulence from rental demand, where you're seeing a huge reduction in renters up to 50% based on what the provincial government cap just said, or the federal government's cap just said. And that could have a huge impact if the market that you just, or were interested in investing in, saw a 4,000% increase in the international student population. And now, you know, so that's 4,000 more renters in that market. And now all of a sudden that gets reduced by 2,000. And a bunch of people rushed into that market, you know, North Bay, Sault Ste. Marie being great examples. People were rushing into those markets to get cash flow. And now all of a sudden the tenant pool dries up and they're renting to long term. You start seeing some people offload because they're distressed, less people lining up to buy the assets. And so there's some headwind from my perspective on both rents and prices in those markets.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. I mean, I'm going to take a leap here and try to come up with a bit of an analogy. So, I mean, Dan, you and I talk a lot to a lot of office brokers, cover the office space. And, you know, we've seen a big shift in the office market right now, right? From class A, which are like the sexy buildings right downtown, all the way down to, and we've done full episodes about this if you want to go back and take a reference on what we're actually talking about here. But I think it's going to be the same thing, right? Like class A buildings in the office environment are still going to be okay for the most part. Where we're really seeing the stress is when you kind of go down that trickle down effect, you get to B and then you get to the C class office buildings. And that's where people are like, why would I be here? I'm getting better rates on A's and B's because they're more desperate. Well, I can see something similar happening to some of these markets with student rentals, right? The renter pool shrinks but there is now, there's still a whole bunch of options for these renters. So where are they going to go? They're going to go to the best asset. So if you've got a really good student rental, you should be okay. But if you've kind of got a dumpy student rental and you're charging too much and the amenities aren't there, well, then I think you are in danger, because just like with everything, when there's just so much demand, people just take what they can get. But when the demand inches back, which is what we're exactly going to see, 50% reduction in Ontario alone, well, are people going to be fighting over the kind of bottom of the barrel rentals? No, they're going to be looking at the medium to good, the class B, the class A stuff. So, you know, using the class ABC from commercial as a commercial office as an example, you know, class A and class B should be fine. Class C stuff is very concerning across the board.
Yeah, it is interesting. I don't know if I have the same sentiment. Like, I would say that in a purely competitive market, if price ends up being where landlords are competing, then yeah, obviously people are going to go towards the better stock if price is independent. But I think that there's a unique ability for lower quality stuff to be priced lower because the purchaser paid less money for it, or because they're like a slumlord and deferring maintenance. And that's not financial advice, don't do that. But if these, like, I think that affordability is such an important thing right now. And so, like, I could almost see it, and this is sort of what you're seeing in some of these office spaces, is like the A's and the C's are succeeding because C's have future potential. You can get them at a huge discount, right? Because they're vacant, because they're distressed. And the A's are, that's where all the tenants are moving, anyone who's still kind of in this return to office thing. And so the middle ends up being, and it becomes this kind of like disparate market. So anyway, does that make sense?
That's a really interesting take. I guess we'll see what happens. I'm sure we'll have an episode on it in the next couple months.
Yeah. So let's hop on to the final piece here, the Renter's Bill of Rights that was just announced. So the bill was specifically geared to help younger people, and he made it pretty clear in their presser from both Sean Fraser and Justin Trudeau that it is, you know, to help young people build credit in a lot of cases. I mean, it seems kind of like a little bit of they're trying to garner some votes here, which worked well for Olivia Chow's election campaign in the city of Toronto, to be fair, to really push towards getting the renter's vote, the tenant's vote. And it seems pretty clear here that that's their objective. I don't know if the policy is going to be as helpful for tenants as they're hoping. But anyway, let's dive into it.
Yes. I mean, you may be thinking another bill. Great. My bills are already super expensive, but it's not that kind of bill. No, this bill, as Dan said, is actually aimed to help specifically young people that, you know, everyone realizes are suffering right now. So a Bill of Rights is a list of the most important rights to the citizens of a country. And since we are in a housing crisis here and a lot of young people are very mad about that, this bill may be one bill that we are actually happy to see.
Yeah, so Ottawa will work with provinces and territories to develop a renter's bill of rights that would introduce a national standard lease agreement and implement requirements for landlords to disclose an apartment's pricing history to allow tenants to negotiate their rent. So this is funny because, Nick, you and I actually, for anyone who's listening, I was at the federal government, that's going to be a difficult thing to execute. But we have this group that they're going to come on the show eventually, but the AI tool that we've been using in the course, they basically, the reason that it works is because they have a huge backlog of rents. They have rental history for the entire country, and so that like could potentially be a huge asset, I would say, for the policy like this to exist. The new measure will also include a $15 million fund for provincial legal aid organizations that help tenants fight against rent evictions and landlord abuse.
Yeah, now nearly two-thirds of younger Canadians rent their homes, and with rapidly rising rents, higher rates, and super low vacancy, rent has become a major pain point for a lot of young Canadians, and I can tell you, I am one of them. So are most of my friends. The new rules will require significant buy-in from the provinces, which, if we know anything about Canadian politics, is definitely going to be a bit of a battle. Now, the three main takeaways here from this proposed bill are: on-time rent payments will be added to your credit score in an effort to help build renter's credit up. However, there is no mention of non-payment of rent and that having a negative effect on your credit score. So bit of a confusion there. Landlords, as you just said, Dan, will need to provide a history of rent prices for that unit, ideally allowing tenants to negotiate. But again, I think some confusion there as well, a bit of a gray area. And then, of course, the tenant protection fund to stop people from such things like bad faith evictions, rent evictions, and whatnot. But Dan, I wanted to turn this back over to you, and maybe this is where we'll finish it off here, is this government has made similar promises like this before with the, what was it, the Home Buyers Bill of Rights that we saw several years ago?
Yeah.
And that never really materialized, did it? So can you remind me what some of those other promises that we never got were, and maybe that we're at risk of maybe kind of seeing a similar thing, and this is just a big song and dance?
Yeah, it is. I think from my perspective, it does seem like a lot of these policies are selling the sizzle and not the steak. So the Home Buyers Bill of Rights promised to get rid of blind bidding, establish a legal right to home inspection, having realtors disclosing all participants to a transaction, creating a beneficial ownership registry, which we covered in depth on this podcast when we're talking about the underused housing tax, which is actually coming up again for deadline. I imagine it'll get pushed, which will be funny. We'll cover it again and talk more about it. But none of these things really happened in a meaningful way. And that was promised in their last, it wasn't the most recent election. I think it was two elections ago. It was their second term. And so it's just hard for me to not be cynical about hearing things like this. Like, I think a tenant protection fund is great. I think that bad faith evictions and bad landlords make our job as good landlords an incredibly difficult task. And they also, they do it by jamming up the court systems, which we've talked about. In the province of Ontario has a record backlog, even though they've hired more adjudicators and are processing more cases. So I think a tenant protection fund from a legal aid perspective is not a bad idea by any means. I think it might end up getting, like, a lot of these conflicts become question marks. And so it's hard to really, like, decipher what's worth spending that legal aid money on, right? And then, but I think that the two other ones are very interesting from my perspective because they aren't that hard to execute if the government is actually serious about doing it. So the on-time rent payments being added to your credit score, because they did mention they would work with fintechs and stuff like that, frontlobby.com, right? They've reached out to us about this. There's a couple of groups in the States as well, but frontlobby.com is a group that already does this. If you're a landlord, you can go to that website. You can do rent reporting, credit building, tenant screening, and debt recovery. And they already have this system. So if you quite literally, it's a great day to be them when I'm sure that they were having a good time hearing this policy. And the same thing, landlords needing to provide a history of rent prices, doorinsight.com, right? DoorInsight has a history of rent prices in Canada. I think that's quite literally what they do. They and appraisers use their rent database. So if you're a tenant and you want to get an idea of what a unit rented for, I think a big thing, I read a breakdown of this policy on an immigration website, CIC, I think. And their perspective is really interesting because I hadn't thought about it this way, but that could really eliminate the risk for a newcomer to Canada being overcharged for a unit because they have no idea what it actually should be worth. And they're just being told and they trust people because, you know, they're told it was a trustworthy place. And so if you can see what it rented for before, you know, in a lot of cases, you're going to be like, oh, it doesn't make me feel better that I'm paying 10% more. But if you're just saying, oh, I'm only paying 10% more, and so, you know, I'm comfortable with that or whatever, I'm not paying 100% more, then so it's, I think it's designed to eliminate some of those negative externalities, just like the Home Buyers Bill of Rights, blind bidding, people overpaying, et cetera. So I honestly think that this is done in good faith. I think that they actually want to make an impact here. I think that they want to do it so that they can get tenants and young people to vote. But some of these things, especially where it's the way they positioned the credit score thing, is like, you can build your credit score so you can get a mortgage, like as if access to more debt is the solution here. And it's just so on brand from my perspective with why we have this problem to begin with.
Yeah, of course we want more debt, right? I mean, our Ontario triple its debt, and Canadians, for every dollar we make, we're $1.82 in debt. And apparently that's not good enough.
yeah, I think it's also, I didn't really mention this, I meant to, but like it goes both ways with the credit score, right? And I found that I responded to both Justin Trudeau's and Sean Fraser's tweets because they both put out videos saying, you know, if you're paying your rent, it'll help you build credit, but nobody mentioned whether or not if you don't pay your rent, if it'll have an impact. And to me, that's basically like more of a support for landlords than tenants. Like I think that, or it's equal support. And so I think that that's actually something that could really do great to balance the outcomes in the housing market. It punishes tenants who are abusive of the system and it rewards tenants who are not. And this is what we need. We need the right incentives, right? And so I think that that actually is making it so that all tenants have credit scores is a huge step in the right direction. On a national level, I really feel that way. I think it is great for tenants who I think good tenants should be rewarded by getting it to show up on their credit. But I also think that good landlords should have the ability to, you know, register if they're not collecting, and that's what they're describing here, right?
Yeah, 100%. Lots to follow over the coming months as we see a lot of this stuff unfold. So that's it for today's episode. Jam-packed full of news, Ontario's budget, student rental caps, budgets not balancing themselves, and a new proposed renter's bill of rights. We will see how it all unfolds, and you best bet that we will keep you updated on this show. Thanks so much for listening, everybody. Go check out the links in the show notes on the course, the community, the upcoming events, and all the other great stuff that Dan and I offer outside of just the show here. And we hope to see you soon. Thanks so much for listening. The Canadian Real Estate Investor Podcast is for entertainment purposes only, and it is not financial advice. Nick Hill is a mortgage agent with Premier Mortgage Center and a partner in the G&H Mortgage Group. License number 10317, agent license M210040037.
Daniel Foch is a real estate broker licensed with Rare Real Estate, a member of the Canadian Real Estate Association, the Toronto Real Estate Board, and the Ontario Real Estate Association.